Welcome to the Classical Records Podcast, a podcast where we discuss hidden cultural circumstances of classical composers. We're linking the composer's life to the 21st century by zooming in on environmental, racial, gender, and mental health topics. So let's dive right in. With me today is Tatiana Dadikima, a pianist from Montreal, Canada, who grew up in Russia and the US. Welcome. Maybe my first question to you is, what was the first time that you heard or played Sergei Rachmaninoff?
Hello. Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to participate in this exciting project. And I'm always very happy to talk about Rachmaninoff. He's one of my biggest musical heroes. And indeed, the memories go to my childhood years. And I can definitely say that I heard him first and then I played him, because as we all know, Rachmaninoff's writing is pretty demanding. So it's definitely not for very, very young kids to be played. But my mom used to take me to a lot of concerts of classical music, and I was particularly fascinated by piano recitals. And so that's where I first heard Rachmaninoff. But if we're talking about the playing experience, interestingly enough, it was on the American soil that I first played Rachmaninoff, because as a teenager, our family moved to the States for 2 years. My father worked at the time at a Russian-American newspaper as a journalist. And so that's where I met my very inspiring piano teacher. And one of the pieces she gave to me after about a year of our work together was Rachmaninoff's Etude Tableau in E flat major from Opus 33. I was about, I think, 12 at the time, so that was a pretty demanding piece. I didn't study music too seriously before that, and I remember it as a great challenge, but also a great source of joy to be playing that piece.
Your piano teacher gave you this piece. Did you talk about being far away from Russia and what that meant, or a certain style of interpretation that you might maybe these days see more reflected in your own practice when you're playing Rachmaninoff? Is there like a Russian way to play things?
Well, definitely now I'm much more aware of the background of Rachmaninoff and his life. At the time, my teacher, of course, she told me a lot of stories. She was a real educator, so she didn't just teach me how to play the piano, but she taught me music, she taught me the philosophy behind it, the other arts that inspired certain works. But that particular piece, the thing is that it was very joyful. It didn't have that sense of nostalgia or melancholy or sadness to it. So it's a very happy sounding piece, very joyful, bright, sparkling, actually coming from dance-like Russian folk tunes. And I think probably it was depicting some Russian national holiday or something similar to Mardi Gras, maybe. So it was very, very festive. Very high-spirited, and at the time, of course, I didn't think of Rachmaninoff as, in the first place, being a person who spent the big part of his life abroad. I didn't know really much about his life, but then I started to get more interested in it when I was older, when we came back to Moscow.
Rachmaninoff left Russia after the Russian Revolution in 1917, and through Scandinavia, finally ended up in the US around 1918. We are looking at a slide right now of the Ivanovka estate, which was a country house that he was composing in the late 19th century. It's located near Tambov in Russia, obviously. And throughout his life, he was dearly missing and trying to reproduce, actually, the life that he had had at the summer house at Ivanovka. And he actually found it occupied by revolutionary forces when he won, right before he left, when he made the final decision, okay, this is not gonna come back, this old Russia. And maybe you can describe to us, what is the old Russia remembered as in today's Russia? So you had basically the Tsarian, if I understand correctly, the Tsarian Empire for more than 400 years, then the revolution comes, you have the communist era until 1990, and What is the old Russia remembered as in today's Russia? Is there also a melancholy in it, similar to what Rachmaninoff was experiencing?
Well, I should say that melancholy is a big part of Russian national character. And so it doesn't really matter what period of history we take. It's just somehow ingrained in the Russian people, probably more in the past than in contemporary Russians, but still it is a big part of it. And some of it is, I think, due to the nature and landscape of the country. So Russia generally, I would say, we don't have much sun. We don't have many, many sunny days. It's a little bit sometimes gray, a little bit sad. And then the views that we see, especially in that part of Russia, not far from Moscow, like we take western part of the country, it's more flat. It doesn't have very spectacular views or any spectacular trees or mountains or anything of the sort, but it's more more modest. But in that modesty, there is a certain beauty and there's a certain notion of really something that people miss when they leave. So we have, for example, the iconic tree would be a birch tree. And so that kind of tree is very dear to Russian people, and they would always, we always have it as a saying that whenever people come abroad, Russian people, they try to have a birch tree nearby their house or find a space where they can go to see the trees. Rachmaninoff, his family belonged to aristocratic layer of society, so that's aristocracy. What comes with that? Of course, it's financially pretty well-off people, but also it's a huge cultural heritage, highly educated people, speaking multiple languages from early on in their childhood. So people from his generation, like Russian writers, Russian poets, would speak easily 2-3 languages, and at the level that they could read on those languages, they could, like Nabokov, for example, famous Russian-American writer, so he could write in Russian and English equally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think Rachmaninoff, he also spoke German and, yeah, and some English as well.
Definitely.
Yeah. So I guess that is something that we'll circle back to, this longing for that old Russia at the end of our conversation. But before that, I'd like to talk a little bit about Rachmaninoff and, well, his health in general, I guess, and where we situate this in the grander context of composition, performance, and teaching, which is, I guess, every musician's trifecta of survival, if we want to say this. So Rachmaninoff got all the classic sicknesses that one could get in the turn of the century. He did experience a pretty severe version of the Spanish flu. He was very sick with malaria, which he actually contracted in his summer house. And as well, he, all his life, he suffered from depression, but also found ways to work around it and work with it as well. Because as Jonathan Noble makes a good point in his publication, That Jealous Demon, My Wretched Health, which is actually a very interesting read, where all composers all sicknesses are lined up, and Jonathan Noble talks about the various composers that were affiliated with it, which I think is very relevant, because I mean, as a creative person, there's so many circumstances around the socioeconomic setup which cause additional stresses, as well as moving around a lot, touring, and so yeah, I hope to talk a little bit about this. First, I want to quote a little passage from Jonathan Noble's publication. In his panorama of Russian culture, Natasha's Dance, Orlando Fix quotes Rachmaninoff as having said in 1941, "I am a Russian composer, and the land of my birth has influenced my temperament and outlook, and music is a product of this temperament." Elsewhere, he had said, "When I left Russia, I left behind the desire to compose. Losing my country, I lost myself also." So Rachmaninoff, he had kind of worked around this mental health thing with one of many alternative ways to address mental health at the end of the 19th century. And I think it was still in Russia that Rachmaninoff was working together with Dahl in order to get around going back to composing, because he had long periods of not being able to compose for 3 or 4 years where nothing, he could produce nothing. And my second quote before I ask you, Tatiana, will be from Vincent de Luise's publication. The article is titled "In Consultation, Rachmaninoff, His Physician and the Genesis of a Masterpiece." And I'm quoting de Luise here. "I heard the same hypnotic formula repeated day after day while I lay half asleep in the armchair in Dahl's study. Dahl would say to me, 'You will write a concerto. You will work with great facility. It will be excellent.'" So Tatiana, talking a little bit about writing and, you know, teaching and touring and all the demands that come with it, what's your opinion or experience with, you know, using maybe mental stressors, but in a creative way?
Well, first of all, if you allow, I would like to comment briefly on that episode with Rachmaninoff. That's a very important thing to touch on. So first of all, the concerto that he wrote next following that hypnotherapy sessions with Dahl was his second piano concerto, arguably the most famous work of Rachmaninoff, or at least one of the most famous works of Rachmaninoff. And he fell into this depression state immediately after the performance of his first symphony that wasn't really well accepted and was severely criticized. Also, the performance itself did not go as well as he expected it to be. They had a very short rehearsal time. So there were reasons, but also he put a lot of effort, a lot of passion into that work. And of course, he was very depressed and very really shocked when this work was not accepted well. And so that's where he couldn't compose for a certain amount of time. And he came out of that dark period of his by writing his second piano concerto, which is actually dedicated to Dahl. So when I opened first the score, again, being just a teenager at school, I was really thinking, who is that? Who is that person he dedicated this concerto to? And then I started reading and doing some research that I could do at the time. And that was pretty fascinating to me because the music sounds very happy, actually, and very positive energies, really positive vibe I can feel and hear through that music. Okay, and then coming back to your question, sorry for this little detour.
Oh, that's great.
So I'm not a composer, so I can't really relate to composition of music. And I definitely can tell that for Rachmaninoff, when he didn't feel well, so that was the period that we discussed, and then another one when he left Russia. So his composition activities were immediately affected in the first place. So he could carry on as a performer, as a pianist. He was a great virtuoso pianist and great musician, performing artist. And so he kept that activity, and also he was conducting for a great amount of years, so he could do that, but he couldn't compose for a lot of time. And he actually wrote the majority of his works while still being in Russia and while still being a young man. Later on, when he got back into composition, he wrote several major works, but only a few of them. And his output was significantly smaller when he lived in the Western country. So he lived in the States. Also, he had his villa in Switzerland, where he tried to recreate exactly that Ivanovka style estate. From the point of view of the performer, yes, definitely there are certain times where psychologically it's much harder to present something on stage. Usually it's related somehow with the outer circumstances, or with just feeling not as comfortable within a certain performing context. Personally, I can say that, definitely in the practicing, there are certain strategies that the performers would use to build the confidence, to build interpretation. And also, it depends on the repertoire. With certain works, one establishes a very close bond, and one is really super passionate about the work or the interpretation of it. With other works, it takes longer time, and there always comes this first performance where sometimes you're unsure of things, and you don't think it's the right moment to present a certain work, and that's where you feel more vulnerable.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant answer, because of what I've learned from my brief research here into Rachmaninoff is that he had such high expectations to himself, and not everything can always be perfect, obviously, and sometimes the self-criticism is so huge on top of whatever everybody else wants to think about somebody. So I can totally see that also playing a huge part in Rachmaninoff's setup as well. And yeah, the expectations that come, especially to somebody who, as you've pointed out, is an important member of Russian culture already at its time. I can only imagine how much pressure that was. So
Exactly. He was really, as you rightly said, he was having always really high expectations from himself, and he had really great contemporaries that were there in the audience where his works were premiered, and including Tchaikovsky, including Rimsky-Korsakov, like all the great names. And of course, there was a pressure from that, but I think also that was his personality. He was really a perfectionist, and in the best sense of the word, because he really felt his potential, and he wanted to realize his creative potential to the utmost, and that's where it came from. And yeah, I can totally see that in him, in his personality.
We'll listen to a short excerpt now of the second movement of the Symphonic Dances. Interestingly, it was originally titled The Fantastic Dances, with the three movements actually titled Noon, Twilight, and Midnight. I was wondering whether there was ever a morning as well. Tatiana, you don't happen to know any details about this working title?
I'm not so sure of it, but yeah, that's true that, well, first of all, music is always subject to a lot of different interpretations, because one can never say this is right and this is wrong. But then I can also tell that I think from all the Rachmaninoff's output, his later works are the more mysterious ones, the more intriguing in terms of what is behind that, and what he had in mind composing these works. So for sure, it's always interesting to come up with all sorts of images and just trying to get into his mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this was written in 1940. Rachmaninoff passed in 1943. So this was, I believe, his last composition that was published. And we'll talk a little bit after this short excerpt. I believe also we hear the brass section. There's also a saxophone that Rachmaninoff included, a very American instrument. This piece, I believe he wrote at the Honeymoon Point in Centerport in New York at one of his also composition breaks. Talking about him in the United States, and maybe your own experience in the United States too, what a crazy coincidence. To be a Russian in the US, what maybe you can kind of either share yours, your perspective, or Rachmaninoff's perspective on.
Okay, that's a very interesting topic. There are both, I would say, similarities and differences, but I can only imagine how fascinating it was in the Rachmaninoff's time, where coming to the US, he could discover all that culture that is so unique, the jazz culture in particular. The harmony of the jazz, that feel of the jazz, the instruments, as you said, yes, and indeed he used the alto saxophone in the symphonic dances. So is that, but also New York in particular is a very specific place in the US. It's a very cultural place. Back in the Rachmaninoff's time also, so many people from European countries that came to US, they settled in New York. So of course there were a lot of Russian immigrants, but not only, because that was a very turbulent time for Europe, where in between the two world wars. And so in the 20s and 30s and 40s, so many people came from other parts of Europe, just escaping. And I would say the best creative forces were really there. And of course, a lot of inspiration could come from that. Manin, when he came, he was also exposed to the new genres, the new sounds. So that I could relate to, definitely.
Mm-hmm, yeah, thank you so much. We're coming full circle here in our short podcast with basically where Rachmaninoff died. One of his estates was in Beverly Hills, and that's where he traveled to after his last tour. He already felt unwell and his health was decreasing. And just to close with, we kind of started with Ivankov, the summer house in Russia, and we're closing with Elm Drive in Beverly Hills. If you look it up these days, it's still standing. You can buy it for $12 million. I think it developed also in something else than in the 1940s, I guess Beverly Hills was just up and coming. Lots of agriculture still surrounding it these days. That's obviously different. And I want to close with a short description of Elm Drive. At his home on Elm Drive in Beverly Hills, Rachmaninoff had two Steinway pianos, which he played together with Vladimir Horowitz and other entertainers. His love of fast cars was second to music and led him to occasional fines for exceeding the speed limit. Since he bought his first car in 1940, Rachmaninoff acquired a taste for fast cars, buying himself a new car every year. His generosity was legendary. He gave away $5,000 to Igor Sikorsky to start an American helicopter industry and many more. So I just abbreviated that quote. So I guess in the end, could we say that Rachmaninoff did accept the American way of life as much as he might have been, you know, struggling or working through it in the beginning? Do you know anything about his American way of life, or where that ever went?
From what I read and from what I discovered, yes, in certain ways he adjusted to that. Partly also because he could surround himself with Russian immigrants just like him, like Vladimir Horowitz was one of them. And by the way, they premiered the two piano version of the symphonic dances that Rachmaninoff also did after he composed it for the orchestra. Yes, to a certain extent, he was surrounded by people from his circles, as he would in Europe or in Russia. He found some American friends. He was really in good friendship with the owners of Steinway. And also what helped him, I think, was that he had his summer estate in Switzerland. So that would be somewhere halfway between Russia and the States. Because I think that he was not only attached to Russia, of course, as his native country, but also to Europe, as the old world, really the space where he used to be performing a lot in his younger years. And so he went there, as far as I know, he went there for his summer breaks. And for example, he composed his Rhapsody on the theme of Paganini in Switzerland, in his estate there, in his villa Senar. That's actually named after his first name and the first name of his wife, so Sergei and Natalia Rachmaninovy. and that's the abbreviation of their names. And so I think that he found his way how to adjust to the circumstances. So that was kind of optimal for him, and that worked for him.
That was so interesting. Tatjana, thank you so much for taking the time here today and enlightening us with your knowledge. And all the best to you, and thank you so much.
My very big pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.